it is gone. A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper. Swing and a miss. He got him. And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run. Reaches up and makes the grab.
Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 322. I'm John Stolness from SB Nation's Phillies blog, The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter, at John Stolness. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Phillies' hellish week in the nation's capital against the Nationals. Just one more game to go as we record this podcast, and mercifully, their last road trip of the season will be over. I'm going to talk to Scott Lauber, Phillies beat writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, about a number of different things, more specifically, where everything went wrong in 2019 and how they get better for 2020. We'll talk about the big free agent debate that will, of course, be talked about a lot in Philadelphia once the playoffs are over and once the Eagles season is a little bit further in the rearview mirror. And I'm going to give you my theory on whether or not baseball is boring or not, because there was a game in Major League Baseball this week that is being cited as among the reasons why the game is struggling the way it is right now. Plus, I will have your stat of the week. But first, a reminder, folks, to head on over to the Hittin' Season Patreon and become a Patreon member of the podcast by going to patreon.com/hittin'season and signing up on the $5 a month tier, and you'll get some good bonus content there. And don't forget to tell your friends about the Hittin' Season podcast and all of the podcasts we have at The Good Fight, especially as we get ready for what will be another busy offseason as this team tries to get better. So just have them subscribe to The Good Fight podcast feed on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify, wherever it is that they get their podcasts. All right, I know you may not want to do it, everybody, but, you know, this is what we're here for. We're here to talk things through. We're here to get through this together, and through these last few games of the season, we will all hold hands as we jump off the cliff together. And this week, the way down was not a lot of fun as the Phillies traveled to the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., for a five-game series, 5 games in 4 days against the Nats. And boy, I'll tell you what, the Phillies were just what the Nationals needed this week to cement themselves with the top wild card spot, which they did this week. The Brewers ended up clinching the second wild card spot, so the National League wild card spots are spoken for. The Phillies were eliminated in the first game of the doubleheader on Tuesday. We'll get to that in just a second. But after the loss on Wednesday night, the Phillies are now a 500 team for the first time this season at 79-79. They were the only team in the National League East to not be at 500 or below at a certain point this season. Remember, they started off 4-0. They've been over 500 the entire season, but now they sit at 79-79, and they have to win 3 out of their last 4, with one of those games being against the Nationals as they try to avoid the 5-game sweep on Thursday. And then they get 3 at home to finish off the season against the Marlins, a 100-loss team. You would think they would be able to do that, but as we know, the Phillies have struggled against Miami this year. So they need 2 wins to beat last year's 80-win total. They have not had a winning season since 2011, and they are really leaking oil as they finish up the season here. They've lost 5 in a row, 7 of 8, 9 of 12, and 14 out of their last 21 games. And unless they win 3 out of their last 4, they will finish with a worse record than the Nats had in any year Bryce Harper was there. And let's talk a little bit about Bryce Harper coming back to Washington, D.C. this week. Obviously, Nationals fans, the few that were actually at the ball yard this week. And let's not kid ourselves. Nationals fans do not exactly show up in droves to watch this baseball team. Those that were there really enjoyed themselves this week. And I don't blame them. I don't blame them. You know, the Phillies went and signed Bryce Harper, and they see Harper as a traitor in much the same way that some Phillies fans saw Jason Wirth as a traitor when Wirth signed with the Nationals as a free agent, even though the Phillies offered him a pittance of what the Nationals were offering him. And so Harper leaves Washington for Philadelphia, and Washington's winning all these ball games, and they know Harper and the Phillies are going to be out of the playoffs. It's especially sweet when you consider earlier in the year the Phillies were feeling really good about themselves in the first series that they played in Washington when Bryce Harper was hitting huge home runs and the Phillies were winning big games against the Nationals in that ballpark. Well, apparently it was pretty cathartic for Nationals fans this week because, based on the reporting from the beat writers, Harper was getting heckled mercilessly in right field in the eighth inning of the game on Wednesday night. And he said it went too far. As of this recording, we don't know exactly what was said. I imagine that might come out in the next day or two. But Harper says that Nats fans crossed a line and that he was eager to get back to Philly and the great fans there. So not really sure what was going on there in right field. I mean, my goodness, we know that Phillies fans have been known to heckle players in the outfield and in the bullpens that are located in the outfield. And I'm sure Harper has a thick skin. I mean, he's been dealing with this kind of stuff his entire career. But maybe the fact that it was happening in Washington just hurts a little bit more because it is someplace I think he still has a lot of affection for. But it's pretty clear Nats fans see him as a traitor and hate his breathing guts. And so he said they went too far on Wednesday night, and that's a real shame because it does remind me a lot of how Phillies fans treated Jason Wirth, which I didn't like that at all. I don't like how Phillies fans treated Wirth when he kept coming back to Philadelphia. I remember an incident when Wirth hurt himself, and Phillies fans cheered as he walked off the field after I think he broke his wrist trying to catch a line drive in a game. So certainly that's not what you want to see, and the Phillies are kind of on the receiving end of that at this point. And it was just kind of the topper on a nightmare week here in D.C. I was at the first game of the doubleheader on Tuesday. It was my birthday on Tuesday, and that was my birthday present. Me and my three boys and my wife and my father-in-law. My father-in-law's a big Nats fan. My oldest son is a big Nationals fan. My middle son is a Phillies fan. And so, we had a little bit of a rivalry going there, but It was great to be there with my family. It was great to take in a ball game. I took off the day from work. So anytime you're playing hooky from work and you're at the baseball game in the middle of the day on a beautiful 75-degree sunny day at Nats Park or wherever it is you're watching a ball game, that's a good day. So it didn't really bother me that I think it was 22 straight Phillies were retired to end the game, that basically no Phillies hitter got on base after the third inning. It didn't really bother me that Brad Miller got ejected, and then the Phillies gave up a go-ahead grand slam again after Aaron Nola got squeezed by the umpire in the second game of the doubleheader. Didn't bother me that I saw the elimination game. It really didn't, because at that point I have long since resigned myself to the fact that Phillies were not going to the playoffs this year. It was just the tragic number reached zero, and that was it. But I will say a couple of things about that doubleheader. One, it was interesting that the Phillies let Aaron Nola throw 114 pitches, more than he has in any other start this year, in a game that did not matter one bit. I don't understand why you would do that in a game that no longer matters, and I hope he doesn't pitch again this year. It does not make sense to me why you would push Nola in this particular situation. He got squeezed by the umpires in the nightcap of that doubleheader. There's no doubt about it. He should have been out of the inning before he was removed, and Trey Turner came in to hit the grand slam that put the Nationals ahead. And the Phillies' makeshift bullpen that they've been putting together with duct tape and rubber bands came apart this week in Washington. We got a good glimpse of why many of these guys were on the scrap heap to begin with and were available for Matt Klentak to go out and get. But I don't understand the Aaron Nola decision. I don't understand leaving him in for as long as they did. I really, really don't. And so that was one of the things that bothered me probably the most about the doubleheader this week. And listen, the Nationals needed these games more than the Phillies did. They were still battling the Brewers for that top wild card spot. They want that home game. They want to be able to pitch Max Scherzer at home in the wild card game, and it looks like the Phillies have helped them line everything up to make sure that that is going to happen. So now that the Phillies are officially out of it, now that the 2019 season, we just got a handful of games left, four games left as we record this, and nothing of consequence is going to happen other than the Phillies are going to try to beat last year's record and try to finish with a winning record, I really don't think anyone in the decision-making process is going to see any difference between an 80-win season, an 81-win season, and an 82-win season. Getting to 82 wins will be a hollow victory for me. It's not even something I care about. I don't care a damn bit about getting to 82 wins and a winning record. I really don't. The disappointment of this season is already so palpable. I could care less if they win three out of their last four and finish with 82 wins. To me, that's almost like papering up a big hole in your drywall and thinking, well, because I put some wallpaper on it, the hole's not there anymore. It's not going to fix the problems that are still there, and it could just be a little bit of lipstick on a pig for a season that really doesn't deserve to have any makeup on. The Phillies deserve to not have a winning record based on how they've played this year. And so I'm not seeing it as any kind of great victory if they finish with 82 wins. And I don't think John Middleton is going to make any decisions based on whether or not they finish with 82 wins. I really don't. I don't think any of that is going to factor into any of their decision making. And the question that everybody is asking right now, the thing that everybody wants to know about, is Gabe Kapler's future. Should Gabe Kapler be the manager of this team in 2020? They're stumbling down the finish line once again. Now, you know, they're obviously dealing with injuries, and they're dealing with other things going on that are kind of out of Kapler's control. He can't help the fact that Real Muto's not going to play any of the last few weeks, and we'll get the last few games, and we'll get to that coming up here in just a minute. We can't help the fact that, you know, he doesn't really have much of a bullpen left at this point. But, you know, here we are. I mean, this is a team that is once again struggling down the stretch. And, you know, it's now time to have the Gabe Kapler conversation in earnest. And I'm not going to call for somebody to be fired. But I did ask on Twitter. I had a couple of polls going. I wanted to know what the public thought, and at least the public that follows me on Twitter, the 7,500 people that follow me on Twitter, and wondering where people are on the manager and potential replacements. So I asked, should Gabe Kapler be the Phillies manager in 2020? About 680 of you voted, and two-thirds of you said no, one-third of you said yes. 67% said no, Gabe Kapler should not be the manager in 2020. A third of you, 33%, said yes. So I also asked, if you don't think that Gabe Kapler should be the manager of this team, then which of these candidates would you like to see? And so the first grouping, I asked about Joe Maddon, Joe Girardi, Dusty Baker, or Dusty Wathan. Those are the four options that I had on the first poll. 1,600 of you voted on this one, and half of you said you would prefer Joe Girardi as the next manager of this team. A little over a third of you said Joe Maddon. Only 1 out of 10 said Dusty Wathan, and Dusty Baker made up 7%. So then I offered another four potential candidates. And I asked if you would prefer Mike Socha, the former Angels manager, Buck Showalter, the longtime Orioles manager and Yankees manager, or Raul Ibanez. And Raul Ibanez's name has been surfacing by a lot of people recently. I know the guys over at the High Hopes podcast mentioned Raul Ibanez, and he seems to be a very popular choice. 53% of the 400 people that voted on this particular poll said Raul Ibanez over Mike Socha and Buck Showalter. I was surprised Buck Showalter only got 15%. Socha got 27% in that particular poll. So I just brought out those different names because each of those guys is a different kind of manager. You know, you got some old school guys like Dusty Baker and Mike Socha. You've got some guys who had some success during the analytics era, but were not necessarily neck deep in analytics, kind of like Buck Showalter and Joe Girardi. And I think, you know, you also had some guys like Raul Ibanez and Joe Maddon. And I don't know what kind of manager Dusty Wathan would be, to be perfectly honest with you. But he's a guy who had success in the Phil's minor league system as a very good manager. I think a lot of the players on the team like him. He's already with the organization. And so I think that could be a possibility as well. I think that would be intriguing. But you know that the Phillies are going to have this conversation because Phillies owner John Middleton is with the team in Washington, D.C. this week. You know that he's asking for opinions on this. You know that those are the different kind of conversations that are being had. And Bryce Harper was asked about Kapler coming back as manager next year. He said, I think his comments were interesting. He said, quote, "I think that is a conversation that if it needs to be had, whether or not the front office would talk to him about the manager, then it will be had." Said Harper, asked what he would say if somebody from the Phillies asked for his opinion. Quote, "But at this point, he is our manager, and I think all of the guys in this clubhouse back him with what he does every single day as manager. The staff that we do have with Rob Thompson and Paco Figueroa and Dusty Wathan and everyone down. If that conversation needs to be had, that's way over my head. There's guys above me that make those decisions. If we do need to have that conversation, I'll be all ears." And remember, back in June, Klintak had this to say about Kapler, quote, Gabe Kapler is our manager. Our staff is our staff. Look, I've been a part of teams that have made in-season staff changes. I understand how that can happen, but right now I do not think that is the right way for us to go. He also had some good things to say about Kapler in the intercom podcast with John Heyman that I played for you guys last week. Still seems to be very much in Kapler's corner. And after the second game of the doubleheader, Kapler was asked about his future, and he said, I'm going to manage this club as long as I can because I think I give us a great chance to win, and I think because I care deeply about the success of this franchise. And Kapler is doing everything he can to try and keep the fan base behind him. He answered some questions for us at The Good Fight. If you go to thegoodfight.com, we threw some questions out at him. And he wanted to answer some questions and wanted to respond to the fans and wanted to respond to us at the blog with some of the criticisms that we've had and ask him some specific questions. And we sent him a bunch. He didn't answer all of them. He picked out a few that he felt comfortable answering, and his answers are verbatim. So you should check out thegoodfight.com and check out the manager's mailbag that we posted this week, and you can hear unfiltered from Kapler himself some of the rationale behind some of his decision making over these last couple of weeks and months. But I don't know that it's going to change any minds. We'll see. Really, the only mind that matters here is John Middleton. That's the only opinion that matters at this point. And so whether or not Middleton is going to buy the narrative that really this team was submarined by injuries, and you can point to Andrew McCutchen and the relievers and Jake Arrieta as the main reason why this team stumbled this year, or whether there might have been other reasons. And if there were other reasons, were they the fault of Gabe Kapler? Did Kapler do everything he could do, given the circumstances that were surrounding him? A third of you feel that way. The poll tells me that, and I've seen that on Twitter. There's a strong pro-Gabe Kapler contingent out there. And so that's what John Middleton is going to have to balance here. He's going to have to balance fan reaction, and he's going to have to balance what he hears from people inside and outside the organization. And it is going to be a fascinating decision because this is a John Middleton decision. Coming up, we're going to talk to Scott Lauber, Phillies beat writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll talk about Kapler's future. We'll talk about what went wrong here in 2019, and we'll talk about the future of this team for next year. How much better can they get, and what is the best way to go about it? That's up next, right here on Hittin' Season. And joining me to talk about the final days of the Phillies 2019 season and maybe take a little bit of a look ahead at 2020 is Phillies reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Scott Lauber. You can follow Scott on Twitter at Scott Lauber. Scott, welcome back to Hittin' Season. How are you?
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I was at the first of the two doubleheader games on Tuesday. It was my birthday, and brought the whole family, brought all the kids. And I was thinking about it as I was watching the game. It was actually kind of a relief that the last 21 Phillies were retired in order and that the game really didn't matter much to the Phillies, because I was in and out of the bathroom so much with the little guys. I didn't get to see as much of it as I would have liked to. But kind of a depressing week here for the Phillies in Washington with their 2019 season now really officially over. And, you know, the question I keep coming back to is, you know, this team failed to meet expectations. So many people had them going to the playoffs. I had them going to the playoffs. And I guess I wanted to ask you, were we deluding ourselves into thinking that this was a playoff team right from jump from the start of the season? Were we so enamored with the offseason that we thought the team was better than it really was?
No, I don't think so. I think if you looked at it realistically, you saw a team that did a lot to improve its lineup, did a lot to improve its offense, and was probably going to have to hit its way to the postseason. But when you looked 1-9 or 1-8 in that lineup, it looked like a lineup that could do that. That could, you know, we saw the Phillies do this back in 07 and 08 and 09 when they were an offense-first team with a rotation that was a little suspect, and they hit their way to the playoffs. And I think a lot of Phillies fans who remember those years looked at this team as a team that could follow suit. You know, yeah, they had their issues in the rotation. And, you know, I was somebody, you know, and I think you and I discussed this as well in the offseason or during spring training, that was wondering, you know, do they have enough starting pitching? And why do they think they have enough starting pitching?
Yeah.
Because if you look at it, they clearly did not.
Yeah.
And, you know, where were they on Keuchel, or where were they on any of those pitchers who signed, especially the ones who signed late?
Yeah.
But you still looked at the roster and you looked at the team and you felt like, you know, that they were a mid-80s win team that could hit its way to the playoffs. And, you know, they fell short of that. They're not going to win in the mid-80s. They're going to be lucky to get to, you know, I guess as we sit here now, they've got to go 3-2 to get to 82-80, which I suppose would paint that as an accomplishment, their first winning record since 2011, a kind of consolation prize to the whole thing. But, you know, they're not going to win in the mid-80s. They're not a wild card team. They really were not. They'll say they were in the wild card race until the final week, and I guess technically they were, but their playoff odds were pretty low for at least 2 or 3 weeks now. You know, and we could point to any number of situations where we felt like that was the dagger for them before they were actually done. But, you know, they fell short of expectations. And, no, I don't think we were being unrealistic. I think that you were looking at the roster and you were seeing a team that you felt like was good enough. And for whatever reason, and there are many reasons, they weren't.
Yeah, I mean, the injuries were definitely one of the reasons. The bullpen was decimated by injuries. What looked like was going to be a strength at the start of the season turned out to not be a strength. But the bullpen, in and of itself, didn't destroy this team. It would definitely cost them some games at different points during the season, but their ERA was kind of middle of the pack as far as bullpen ERA in Major League Baseball is concerned. I was looking at some of the numbers this morning, and really so many of the players that were on last year's team and were held over for this year's team. And then you include guys like Gene Segura, who had three straight seasons where he was a 300 hitter and was a well above league average hitter. He really took a big step backwards this year.
Mm-hmm.
Guys like Rhys Hoskins took a big step backwards. And then virtually every pitcher in the starting rotation took a step backwards. So to me, I don't look at the injuries quite as much. I see a lot of guys who came back from last year who just simply had down years this year. And I don't know whether to feel good about that they might bounce back next year, or whether this is kind of emblematic of coaching issues going on at the big league level. What's your take on some of these guys who last year were playing well and this year really took a step back?
I think it's indicative of a few things. I'll start with the front office, because I mentioned it in my last answer. You know, I felt then and I feel now like they looked at their rotation like one of those funhouse mirrors. Like, you know, my son is three and I take him to preschool every day, and we walk down the hall to get to his classroom, and they have two of those funhouse mirrors, one that makes you look really tall and one that makes you look really little.
Yeah.
And I think they looked at their rotation and they saw a distorted picture that from what most other people in baseball saw. You know, they looked at Zach Eflin and Vince Velasquez and Nick Pivetta, and they saw, you know, grown up big boy, big league starting pitchers, and all three of them. And when in reality, I think they would have been lucky if one of them really emerged as a solid big league starter. You know, they all had flashes last year of promise, but we know, because we've seen it too much, that player development, especially pitching, is not a linear thing.
Right.
So just because you have a good year one year does not automatically mean you're going to take a step forward the next year, which is why I say that they were counting on at least one and probably two of those three to really take a step forward. And I think that was a foolish bet to make, especially when I think they overestimated their depth behind those guys.
Yes.
You know, Cole Irvin or Eniel De Los Santos or any of those guys were obviously not ready for primetime AAA pitchers. So, you know, I think they fell down there in building the rotation. And then, you know, there's certainly a coaching element to this as well. You know, they were not coached up for whatever reason. And, you know, Chris Young is good at a lot of things. One of them is looking at video and I think breaking down a pitcher's strengths and weaknesses and scouting, and he has a scouting background. That's where he came to them from, as a scout for the Astros. Where I think they maybe lacked a little was, you know, on the coaching side of things. So it's one thing to identify a weakness. It's another thing to fix it in the bullpen and to show a guy or teach a guy or help a guy realize, beyond just looking at numbers or video, you know, where he's going wrong. And Maybe that was not a strength of Chris Young's, the coaching element of it. So, you know, I think that they built their rotation, you know, in such a way that it was flawed, and then they didn't help those guys very well when they did struggle. And then, you know, look, let's put a lot of this, too, at the feet of those pitchers. I mean, you know, Nick Pivetta was supposed to have a breakout year. He had an awful year to the point where I'm not really sure how you can look at him as a part of much of anything here next year.
Yeah.
Maybe he's a change of scenery guy in the offseason, and he has to go somewhere and start fresh. Velasquez has had, you know, good moments and bad moments, but he's still, at the end of the day, mostly a five-inning pitcher. And is that good enough? It's certainly not good enough to be more than a number five. And then there's Eflin, who, you know, had such a good start to the point where we were talking about, you know, is Zach Eflin an all-star?
Yeah, sure.
That was actually a conversation that was going on in early June and mid-June, and then to fall down the way he did, and then to kind of, I don't want to say save a season, because I don't believe he did that per se, but to kind of have a little bit of a revival at the end when he decided more or less to do his own thing.
Yeah.
You know, so there are a lot of things there to sort of dig into, and you could probably do a full podcast on each guy, or certainly just on the rotation by itself. But lots of areas where the rotation just didn't do enough. And to me, it starts with how they built it.
Yeah, it's a long offseason. I might do just what you suggested, because it's going to be a long offseason. We're not watching the Phillies in the playoffs. Obviously, so much of the city, so much of what Phillies fans are talking about is the future of Gabe Kapler. And I don't like calling for guys to lose their jobs. I imagine most writers don't enjoy calling for managers to lose their jobs. But I will point people to a piece that you wrote that I think was really good, and it was, I think, misunderstood by a lot of people on Twitter, about how the team should not be making a decision one way or the other on Gabe Kapler based on public opinion. Can you expand on that a little bit and kind of what you're saying there? Because I don't think you're advocating one thing or the other, just that the criteria that you have to use, whether or not you're going to bring Kapler back or not, has to be something more than just the fans don't like him.
Yeah, thanks for calling it misunderstood, because I'm glad you said it rather than me.
No, it was. I got a lot of Twitter blowbacks. I think I quote tweeted it, and I was like, you know, guys, read the thing, you know.
Yeah, well, no, I got a lot of emails about it, which I welcome. I welcome that all the time, and you know, that feedback's always good, and I wanted to answer all of them, but didn't have that kind of time.
Sure.
This just sort of explained that you know, I think I wrote explicitly in there, look, this is not about whether he should or shouldn't come back next year. And it's probably not, you know, it's hardly falls into the category of a hot take or anything like that to sit here with 5 days left in the season and tell you that I'm kind of, in all honesty, undecided as to how I feel about that. And I think, to be honest with you, I think John Middleton is undecided. If you ask him right now today at 2:00 on Wednesday afternoon, whether his manager should be back. The point I was trying to make with that column is that, you know, one of the last really big decisions that the organization made was to sign Bryce Harper. And I heard enough people, including John Middleton himself, refer to Todd Zielecki's Twitter poll in the middle of February about, you know, I think it was something like, would you prefer Harper or Machado? And then there were elements in there like, do you want them to sign Harper? Do you think they will? And whatever it was, Harper got like 86% approval as opposed to Machado. And,
right.
And Middleton himself referred to that poll as one of the reasons why they decided to pass on Manny Machado and go, you know, full bore after Bryce Harper. And I heard him say that, and I thought, okay, that's on one hand, there's something I think admirable about listening to your customers, your paying customers. There's also something alarming about that.
Yeah.
And if you're going to make decisions as an organization strictly based on opinion polls and talk radio calls, then I don't think you're going to be very successful. I'm sure that John Middleton didn't make his decisions on his family business based on what, you know, well, I mean, look, he wasn't asking the public what they thought about cigars,
right.
But I mean, you know, I'm sure that he would agree that that's not a wise way to make decisions about his business. So for me, it was like, look, you know, Gabe Kapler was never a popular guy from the minute they hired him. People made fun of him for his blog and how he looks and how he sounds. And you know, I've written this before. He looks and sounds and acts like no other Phillies manager before him, and probably none who will come after him.
Right.
And because of that, he's never been a popular figure. He's never been the people's choice. And so if you're going to listen to WIP, or you're going to listen to Twitter opinion polls and make your decision about whether to keep or can your manager based on that, I think that's dangerous. And I think that the situation is far too complex for that. You know, I think that he's done some things that make you scratch your head. There's no question about it. And if they think that they can do better, you know, if they think that they can get Joe Girardi, or they think that Joe Maddon's going to be available, and I think a lot of us think he will be, if they think Buck Showalter is someone who might want to manage again, and if they think that those guys can make them a better team, I said, by all means, go and hire those guys. But you got to realize, too, that, I think that they were, all things considered, I think that they were in the wild card race legitimately for, well into August and maybe even early September, given all the things they went through. And Gabe Kapler deserves a little bit of credit for that as well. I think if you ask most of the players, I think they generally play hard for him. I think that they generally like playing for him. Maybe that's a good thing and maybe not. Mm-hmm. But, again, like I said, I wasn't necessarily saying keep him, and I'm certainly not going to stand on that hill and scream keep him, because, you know, at the end of the day, the guy's one game under 500 in 2 years, and that's not good. But at the same time, you know, I just think a lot of this, you know, this noise out there about fire Kapler, I mean, you wouldn't believe, and I'm sure you get it too, John, mm-hmm. like, you know, things go wrong in a game and people tweet at you, you know, fire Kapler, and he had nothing to do with literally, like, Gene Segura makes a throwing error and somebody tweets fire Kapler. Like, well, yeah. Did he make that throw? Like, who else should be playing shortstop? So, you know, there's just this natural reaction to say fire the manager, and I think that they've got to be a little bit more, and I think I hope Middleton will be a little bit more careful about how he weighs the decision.
It'll be interesting to see what criteria he uses, because I think if he were to talk to Matt Klentak, I gotta believe Klentak will stump for his manager, because he was the first manager Klentak ever hired, and we all know Andy McPhail told Klentak, you only get one or two of these, and, you know, he really took a chance on a guy who had never really managed before in any capacity. We've seen other teams who have hired managers who never managed before, and they're having success, so it's not necessarily a recipe for a losing team or a losing season, but so far, you look at the results, they haven't been there. But I will also say, too, managers and success is kind of like the FBI. You know, their successes are generally not touted, but the failures are public.
Right.
You know, Brad Miller is the cleanup hitter in the second game of the doubleheader last night. Nobody's really talking about the fact he hit two home runs. And I'm not stumping for Gabe Kapler, because he's done a lot of things that I think were wrong, too. I also think, you know, that he's done some things right that probably we never thought about, because we don't talk about the good things a lot of times. But, you know, what kind of criteria do you, I mean, who's Middleton talking to when he's going to make a decision? Because I really wonder if he's talking to Klentak, it's probably going to be a largely positive conversation about Gabe Kapler.
Yeah, and it's interesting, because it's probably, some of this is probably going on as we speak. John Middleton's here in Washington. The front office is here. I wouldn't be surprised if maybe they met with Gabe Kapler this afternoon, who knows, or maybe tomorrow. Generally speaking, what happens when a team gets eliminated is they do have a series of meetings, the manager, the general manager. They usually meet individually with every player. You remember last year they came back from Colorado, had the three games at home, and Gabe Kapler was in meetings with Andy McPhail and John Middleton and Matt Klentak and players for most of those 3 days. So it wouldn't be unusual if they're in the hotel in D.C. and they're having a series of meetings. And I'm sure that, you know, if John Middleton is, I'm sure that John Middleton is asking a lot of people a lot of questions, like we all are. Like, what went wrong? You know, where did this get off the rails? Why is this team that I spent $500 million on in the offseason not in the playoffs? And I'm sure he's hearing a lot of different things. You know, one of the things we've already heard from Matt Klentak is they're leaning hard on the injury narrative.
Yeah, they are.
It's not the whole story by any stretch, but if I'm being honest, it's you can't discount it. Yeah. And you know, I've had a lot of people say to me, like, well, what about the Yankees? I mean, the Yankees overcame all those injuries. I would argue that the Yankees are the outlier here.
Yeah.
And a lot of teams that suffer those sort of injuries don't survive it. Mm-hmm. And I think most of baseball right now is sitting around talking about the Yankees and saying, what on earth did they do so right that they were able to come out the other end of that? I know the Red Sox are having that conversation because they've got to be as confused as anyone as to why the Yankees didn't falter or slow down.
Yeah.
So, you know, I agree with you that I think Klentak is advocating quite hard for Gabe Kapler to stay. I'm sure they're leaning on that injury narrative. I'm sure they're saying, like, hey, we had to rebuild the bullpen literally on the fly as the season was going on, and it was actually pretty good. I found myself in a lot of games the last 2 months of the season thinking, like, I'm going to write about the bullpen again, and I can't believe I'm going to do this because I don't really, like, every fiber of me says I don't want to believe in these guys, and yet they've pitched fairly well,
yeah.
Blake Parkers and the you know, Mike Morins and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So, you know, so I'm sure that that's what Middleton's hearing a lot of. Now, at the end of the day, he has every right to then look at Matt Klentak and say, okay, I hear what you're saying, but I mean, do you think that's going to fly with the fan base?
Yeah.
And how do we sell that? And, you know, are people going to be storming Citizens Bank Park with pitchforks if I don't make some changes? And again, that goes to making changes based on public opinion. And if that's the only reason they have to do it, maybe they shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
But if they have real reasons and if he has real questions that he doesn't get sufficient answers to, then he's going to want to make changes. And I think it probably it's a better chance that it falls on the manager, given his contract situation with 1 year left, than the general manager who he extended in spring training and has 3 years left. So
right.
I would put Kapler on a quite considerably hotter seat than Klentak right now, even though maybe they should be on equally hot seats.
A couple of quick things before we finish up here. On a positive note, what do you think was the best thing to happen to the Phillies in 2019?
Oh, wow.
I know. Nobody's mind is oriented in that direction right now.
Yeah. Boy, I didn't expect that question because we're definitely not in that mode right now. Look, I would say that, you know, at the top end of the roster, they made some good decisions. I mean, JT Realmuto is the MVP of the team. And I think a lot of people, when the trade happened, you know, there was the question of like, well, this is the move before the move because we were all expecting Machado or Harper. And I think a lot of smart people around the league stopped and said, well, regardless of what they do next, they just got their MVP. And it turns out they did. He was an absolute Iron Man behind the plate. And I don't know how you look at his season and you say that it fell short in any way of what people expected. And in that same vein, I think Bryce Harper wound up having a really good year.
Yeah.
You know, I really do. I think, you know, you could look at his year and you could make an objective claim that he had the second best year of his career.
I agree.
After the MVP year in 2015. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I think that they probably got the justification that they wanted from the way he played that was the right decision. I think it was promising that Aaron Nola turned his season around, at least in terms of the things he could control, you know, not the seven straight starts that they lost of his at the end of the season, but rather that he had a bad April and early May and then looked a lot like Aaron Nola circa 2018 again through the middle of the season. And that was encouraging to see because you did wonder there early in the year, like, you know, was there a year after effect, you know, and did he have the year of his life and would he be the same guy again? He was very much the same guy again through the meat of the season, you know, so that's the top of the roster. And I've said this to a lot of people. I feel like if you look at their roster, you know, 1 through 25 and certainly 1 through 40, the 40-man roster, you take their five, you know, and you ordered them 1 through 40, you would take the top, you know, all 29 other teams would probably take 1 through 5, you know, whether
yeah.
it's in whatever order you want to order them, Harper, Realmuto, Nola, for sure, those three. Most teams would still take Rhys Hoskins and most teams would still take probably, you know, a guy like Scott Kingery who can play everywhere. But it's the middle and the bottom of that roster that I think really needs to get a bit of a reshaping. And, you know, maybe that's part of this for Matt Klentak. Maybe he tells John Middleton, look, we spent so much of our time last winter building our core.
Yeah.
You know, figuring out how to trade for Real Muto, figuring out which free agents to sign. You know, and it could have gone in so many directions. Had they signed Patrick Corbin, would they have still signed Andrew McCutchen? You know, had they done this, would they have done that? If they don't trade for Gene Segura and Carlos Santana is still on the roster, you know, how does it look there? So, you know, he could probably make the argument that they spent so much of their offseason literally building their core that they didn't really have the time to sort of pay as much attention to their depth. And now maybe this offseason they can look at the middle and bottom of their roster and their depth behind it and really take a hard look at that and fix that problem, because they clearly were not as talented, let's say 10 through 25, or as deep beyond 25 as they needed to be.
Well, that dovetails really nicely into my final question. I think a lot of fans are going to be looking at two big free agent pieces to the puzzle as Gerrit Cole and Anthony Rendon this offseason, and I don't think anybody believes the Phillies could or should sign both of them, but obviously if money's right. Not an object, great, but it probably is.
If it's stupid money again,
yeah,
sure,
I mean,
why not, right?
Who knows? But if you had to choose one, because we've talked about the offense performing far below expectations, and we've talked about the starting pitching and how desperately they really do need an injection of talent there, which would you go after if you had to choose one, all things being equal, Cole or Rendon? Obviously understanding that each guy's contract is going to be a little different.
Yeah, I mean, well, look, they're both going to be well over $200 million. So in that sense, they're going to be similar. They're going to be similar price point, I should say. Good cases could be made for both. And under, you know, normal circumstances, I'd say 90% of the time, if I'm looking at a position player and a pitcher, both of whom are going to be the same price point, both of whom are, I think they're the same age, or they're roughly the same age. It's probably going to be a similar length of contract as well. 90% of the time I go with the position player, because I say, look, you know, that pitcher's one pitch away from blowing out his arm and who knows what happens. And,
yeah,
you know, for the same reason that I think the Phillies have focused on drafting position players over pitchers in the last several drafts, you know, I feel the same way about the free agent market. Having said that, I prefer Gerrit Cole for the Phillies, because I just think their rotation needs that much more help than their lineup does. Rendon happens to play the right position, I guess, right? He plays third base.
Yep.
And, you know, you could conceivably, if you believe in Alec Boehm, you could conceivably move him to first and maybe think about trading Rhys Hoskins, although I don't think the Phillies would entertain that. You know, that is the one position, third base, where they really need the most help. And Boehm is probably not going to be ready from day one next season. So, but, you know, like I said, having said all that, I lean to Gerrit Cole because their rotation just needs so much help. I don't, you know, there's no one in AAA who's going to step in and be a dominant guy next year. Even if you see Spencer Howard here, and I do by the middle of the season, you know, there's going to be a learning curve for him. And you are not at the stage as an organization where your window to contend is in line right now with your pitching development. I mean, they're whatever pitchers they have in their system who are any good are AA and lower. And so it's going to take time for them to get here. So for me, I got to get Gerrit Cole. I got to put him at the top of my rotation with Aaron Nola. You know, I got to hope that, you know, Spencer Howard comes up in the middle of the season and he's pretty good. And then, you know, you're probably going to have Jake Arrieta in the mix next year, because I don't know, you know, he's not going to opt out. I don't know how you move that contract after the year he had with the physical issues. I think that there's probably a spot to be fought for between guys like Eflin and maybe Smiley if he's back, or, you know, that was a guy who, look, was a no risk move for them, and he pitched okay. He wasn't horrible. You know, and as a guy who you might want to look at, he's left-handed and got some upside still. So I think there's a spot at the back of the rotation for those guys to duke it out. If you want to throw Velasquez in that mix, to duke it out with those guys for one spot. But you really, really still need a big guy at the top with Nola. And I think Gerrit Cole's that guy. If Strasburg opts out, I think he still ends up back in Washington. People I'm sure would love Cole Hamels back here, but his age, you know, is he a guy you can count on at the tip, you know, at the top? He's more a middle guy now. So Cole's the guy for me, and you know, he's a Boris client. Boris and Middleton have developed quite the relationship
over the last
couple of years. You know he's going to sell Gerrit Cole hard to Philadelphia. And, you know, that's the one I would do. And there's obviously a huge risk there. He's a pitcher. But he's had an unbelievable year. He's going to get a huge contract, and the Phillies should be at the front of the line.
Well, it'll be a fascinating offseason, but first, hopefully we'll get some decisions on who's going to be a part of this team on the coaching staff a few days after the season is over, I would imagine, and then we can kind of move on with our lives and see where we're going for 2020. But folks, make sure that you follow Scott Lauber on Twitter if you don't already. It's at Scott Lauber, and make sure to check out all of his fine reporting for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's in D.C. to cover the last couple games of the series. Scott, thanks so much for coming back on Hittin' Season. I appreciate it.
Sure thing, John, anytime.
Well, up next, we're going to take a look at one player in particular who was really a major reason why this team struggled in 2019 that isn't getting talked about a whole lot. And I want to revisit the Phillies' offseason moves and a tweet by Fox Sports about the teams that went out and signed some of those big-time deals this offseason. We'll do that next, right here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season, and with the 2019 season wrapping up, I think now's a good time, and we're going to spend a lot of time, obviously, over the next couple of weeks looking back at the season and figuring out what went wrong, but we are going to spend most of our time looking forward at this point, because no one wants to keep reliving this season. But we've often criticized Rhys Hoskins on the podcast for how he's finished up the season. We talked about Scott Kingery's struggles in the second half. We've talked a lot about the starting pitching and the bullpen issues. One player who was acquired this offseason who really failed to live up to expectations, who we haven't talked a whole lot about, is Gene Segura. He's had a really down year, and his lack of production helped stall this offense in a big way. From 2016 to 2018, three full seasons in which he was an everyday starter and played a lot of games, he hit .308 during those three seasons with a .353 on base and a .449 slugging, an OPS plus of .115 over those 3 years. This year, his average dropped from .308 to .279. His on-base percentage dropped from .353 to .323. And his slugging percentage fell from .449 to .423. His OPS plus fell from .115 to .91. When the Phillies made that trade this offseason, everybody thought Klintak pulled off a great move because they rid themselves, quote unquote, of Carlos Santana, who was okay at first base last year, but he was not the impact bat the Phillies were hoping. And it meant they were able to move Rhys Hoskins out of left field, where he was a disaster defensively, and put him at his natural position, first base. Well, Carlos Santana gets traded to the Mariners and then gets dealt to the Indians, his old team, and this year has become one of the best first basemen in baseball, has the second highest Fangraphs wins above replacement among major league first basemen at 4.6. Santana this year hitting .286 with a .402 on-base percentage and a .525 slugging percentage. He could win, and he probably will win, the Silver Slugger at first base in the American League this year. Has a weighted runs created of .138, 34 homers, 110 runs, and 93 RBIs. He has been a powerhouse in that Cleveland lineup. A powerhouse. This player was not here last year. I don't know where this Carlos Santana was in Philadelphia, but we didn't get this guy. And does it have to do with Phillies coaching, or is he just more comfortable playing in Cleveland? I don't know what the hell happened. But Santana, although he walked a lot last year, couldn't buy base hits, didn't hit for a lot of power, and clearly was not a 4.5 win player last season. And you compare him to Rhys Hoskins. Santana has the second highest FWAR among first basemen at 4.6. Hoskins is exactly half that at 2.3, which ranks 11th among first basemen in the majors. .286 average for Santana. Rhys Hoskins averaged down to .228. The on-base percentage from Santana's .402, Rhys Hoskins down around .365. And the slugging percentage, .525 for Santana, for Hoskins, about .463, I believe, through Wednesday's action. Weighted runs created of .116, 29 homers, 84 runs, 84 RBIs for Hoskins, just not getting it done at first base. And so while the Phillies did get better offensively at shortstop, over, say, J.P. Crawford, who would have been their starting shortstop last year, Crawford did not have a very good season offensively for Seattle. But Segura fell well short of expectations at shortstop. Obviously, he was involved in those hustle plays from earlier in the season, which got blown up by the media and blown up by sports talk radio. And, you know, I certainly want my players to run when they can. But, you know, we also tend to go overboard a little bit with the hustle narrative. But nevertheless, Segura did not do enough offensively to mitigate a lot of that criticism, and did not give the Phillies the 300 average and the 350 on base and the quality at bats that they were hoping to get out of him this year. And I also want to address a tweet by Fox Sports. They put out a tweet, I think it was on Tuesday, in which they featured the four players who signed the biggest contracts this past offseason: Mike Trout, Bryce Harper, Manny Machado, and Nolan Arenado. Talking about and almost gloating about how none of those guys are going to be in the playoffs this year. And of course, there's no context to that tweet. And you have idiots saying, "I told you so. I predicted that." You know, it's not that difficult to predict that the Angels would not go to the playoffs this year, because they weren't adding Mike Trout. They were simply retaining Mike Trout. All of the problems the Angels had in 2018 and all of the years before that when they missed the playoffs were still there. They just had them with Mike Trout and kept Mike Trout for the long term. Same thing with Colorado. Colorado's problems were not because of Nolan Arenado, and the Rockies were not. It's not that the Rockies couldn't field a competitive team because they signed Arenado to that long-term deal. All of the pitchers who were really good for Colorado last year fell apart in 2019. It had nothing to do with the Arenado signing. The Padres were never supposed to go to the playoffs this year. Signing Machado was a move that was set for the next 5 to 7 years as their young players, as their young core came up. Of course the Padres and Machado didn't make the playoffs. I think the one team out of all of those teams, well, the Rockies were disappointing in that they should have been a playoff team based off of last year, but the Phillies certainly were disappointing. But the Phillies, I think we are seeing, had a ton of work to do. And can you imagine if they hadn't signed Bryce Harper this offseason? To imply that it was a stupid move, or that it was foolish, that it is foolish to spend that kind of money on a player like that, is disingenuous at best and flat out lying at worst. And I don't see why we have to disparage teams that spend a lot of money on players. If you've got the money to spend on players, spend it on the players. Why are we puffing up these teams that go out of their way not to spend money when they could? Nothing is forcing the A's and the Rays to not spend money. Their owners have a lot of money. Now, I mean, are they operating from they're operating from a profit-based system? And maybe the baseball team that they own doesn't generate as much of a profit as certainly the Yankees or the Red Sox or the Phillies do. They don't have the kind of cable TV deals or the stadium deals that those teams do. But there's also no reason why they have to do things the way that they're doing. And teams with lots of money should not be encouraged to be cheap. And that's what this tweet is doing. It's encouraging teams, saying, "You're stupid if you spend a lot of money on players." Well, it's just a lot of nonsense. And as we're looking back at Harper versus Machado, I think it's clear to say the Phillies made the right choice. Not just based on fan excitement and engagement, for one, of course. Harper by far was the best pick. Have you heard anybody mention the name Manny Machado this year? Bryce Harper's name has been on the tip of a lot of people's tongues. He's had some big moments this year for the Phillies. He's a lightning rod. Everybody in the game, he's obviously the marquee star in this game, even though he's clearly not the best player in the league. But Phillies fans obviously love what Bryce Harper brought to the team this year. And you haven't heard, even though he plays on the West Coast, you haven't heard Manny Machado's name mentioned in baseball circles all season long. So there's something to be said for having a guy like Bryce Harper, who is the talk of baseball oftentimes. And if you look at the results on the field, Harper has had a much better season than Manny. By Fangraphs, wins above replacement, Harper's at 4.4, Machado 2.6. By Baseball Reference, wins above replacement, Harper 3.6 to Machado's 2.9, a little closer there. By OPS Plus, Harper's at 123, Machado 106. And by wins probability added, Harper 5.61, fourth best in baseball. Machado 0.18, that ranks in the 200s. Harper's been a very clutch hitter for the Phillies this year. So obviously, Phillies fans should be very happy that they made the decision that they did, going with Bryce Harper as opposed to Manny Machado. It was looking a lot closer by midseason, but Harper's hot streak here in the second half, where he's really put it together, has made all the difference. And I think we are going to look back at the season, as Scott Lauber mentioned a few minutes ago, this being the second best season of his career from beginning to end, when you factor in defense and base running and offensive production. Really great season from Bryce Harper. I'm very satisfied with what he gave the Phillies this year. Also mentioned a minute ago, JT Realmuto will not play the rest of the season. He is most likely going to have a meniscus cleanup in his right knee on Friday. They said that he started to feel some discomfort as he was running the bases against the Indians back in Cleveland. Kapler said, "We don't have any long-term concerns about this for JT. It's a similar procedure to what Jake Arrieta had. He was back in 2 weeks, back throwing and back on the mound." Realmuto's season is finished with a .275 batting average, 36 doubles, 3 triples, 25 homers, 83 RBIs, and an .820 OPS. He set career highs in runs with 92, doubles, homers, RBIs, and slugging percentage, .493. He joins Johnny Bench and Jorge Posada as the only catchers in baseball history to have 90 runs, 35 doubles, and 25 homers in a season. Defensively, he will probably win the Gold Glove this year. If he doesn't, they should abolish the award entirely. He started 130 games behind the plate, which is 11 more than any catcher in baseball. He caught 76 and two-thirds more innings than anybody else. Threw out 37 base runners, which was 15 more than anybody else. He was 8th in framing runs, according to Baseball Prospectus. Had the best pop time in the game and the second strongest arm. His 5.6 wins above replacement was 7th among position players in the National League. He could be a top 5 MVP candidate based on how some things shake out, although probably not now that he's missed the last few games of the season. And one final thought before I leave you. I mentioned that I went to the Phillies game, the first game of the doubleheader on Tuesday, and I got to admit, the actual game on the field was pretty darn boring. It was a 4-1 Nationals win. The Nationals scored 2 of their runs on sacrifice flies. There were actually no home runs in the game. And of course, the Phillies, they didn't have a guy get on base after the third inning. I mean, it was just an exceptionally boring game. But I wanted to mention a game between the Rockies and the Giants on Tuesday night that went 16 innings. And by the time it was over, the teams had set a new record for the most pitchers used in a game with 25. The Rockies and Giants combined to use 25 pitchers in that game. And Jeff Passan of ESPN, friend of the podcast, called it the archetypal 2019 Major League game. There were a record 25 pitchers used. There were 8 home runs hit, which accounted for 12 of the 13 runs. There were 35 strikeouts. Hitters went 20 for 111 in the game for a .180 batting average, and the game lasted 5 hours, 31 minutes, which for a 16-inning game, the average would have averaged out to about 3 hours and 5 minutes. It was a 3-hour and 5-minute 9-inning pace, which is exactly the average length of a baseball game this season, by the way. Major League Baseball has set its season strikeout record for the 12th straight year this year. On Tuesday, there were 369 strikeouts, which again set the record for most strikeouts in a season, 41,467. But since 2008, that number has gone up every single season, breaking the record year after year after year. In 2001, there were 32,404 strikeouts, 10,000 strikeouts fewer. In 96, there were less than 30,000 strikeouts during the course of the season. I mean, it's just, there are so many strikeouts going on in baseball, but there's also been a record number of homers. The league entered play Tuesday with 6,550, which surpassed the record of 6,105 set in 2017. For the second time in 2 years, there have been more strikeouts than hits in Major League Baseball this season. And I've never really noticed the game being a whole lot more boring, because I just don't go to many games anymore. Most of the games I watch are on TV. It's not nearly as boring to watch a game on TV as it is to watch the game at the stadium right now. It was really noticeable how infrequently the ball is put in play when you're at a game watching it. It's far more noticeable than when you're at home, because you're inundated by the scroll along the bottom with different scores, and you've got the announcers to kind of take you through the game and listen. And, you know, listen, whether you like Tom McCarthy and Ben Davis and John Kruk and Mike Schmidt and all those guys or not, it's at least something to distract you from the action. They're talking to you and taking you through the game. When you're at a Major League Baseball game and there are so few balls put in play, it is way more noticeable. It is way more noticeable how much slower the game is and how much less is going on the field. I think that's why guys like John Smoltz and other announcers and baseball writers who cover a lot of games at the stadium in person, I really think that's why they are blowing the whistle on this so much, why they are screaming from the mountaintops about the state of the game. Because when you're at the game and you don't have those distractions and you're not, I mean, like me, I was taking my kids to the bathroom every 5 minutes and running to get cotton candy and hot dogs. And so I didn't feel like I was missing anything. And that's the thing. Like, I used to hate getting pulled away from the action to go have to do something like that, to go to the bathroom, to go get a soda or a beer or popcorn or hot dog or whatever. At the game on Tuesday, I didn't mind because I knew I really wasn't missing much. That's a big problem. That is a problem. And I have poo-pooed people saying that the game is terrible, that it sucks. It's not a bad game. It's not a terrible game. The state of baseball is not horrible. But it is missing something when you're there. You know, I mean, you can go and you can have a great time. Going to a baseball game is still a great time. I still love to go. There are some stadiums that are more easily accessible than others. I think Citizens Bank Park is very easily accessible. Nationals Park is not easily accessible. So that was also part of the problem, trying to get in and out of that place. But games are just more, most games are not as exciting in person at this point. And I think it'll turn around. I think at some point we will see a reversal. More balls will get put in play. Teams will learn how to deal with the shift, and there won't be quite as much of a desire to hit the ball in the air and create a lot of strikeouts and home runs and pop-ups and all that. But for right now, when I went to that game on Tuesday, I finally saw it. I finally saw why a lot of people think the game is boring and why it's in a little bit of trouble. And I got to say, based on my experience on Tuesday, and it probably is partly to do with the fact that the Phillies did not have a runner reach base after the third inning, but part of that is because there were a lot of strikeouts and there weren't many hits and guys are not putting the ball in play. So it's definitely something that I noticed for the first time on Tuesday, and hopefully baseball things change and things turn around and we start to see the action-packed sport that we grew up on a little bit more often. It doesn't have to totally go back to the 1980s. It's never going to be that sport again. But I think there's just got to be a little bit more going on, or else it's kind of a boring sport to go watch. And that's coming from somebody who does not think baseball is boring in any way, shape, or form. All right, let's get to our stat of the week. Rhys Hoskins, finally, broke his ofer. He had a long ofer going here towards the end of September. But in the fourth inning of the series finale against the Nationals, Hoskins snapped an 0-for-26 with an RBI single in the fourth inning. Did you know that Hoskins coming into the game had 24 RBIs in the second half? And I know RBIs are not an individual stat, or they're as much a team stat as an individual stat. I'll go that far. But hitting in the cleanup spot in this lineup, Hoskins had just 24 RBIs coming into the game on Wednesday. 148 major league players had more. Just a really terrible finish to the season for Rhys Hoskins. Folks, that'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Scott Lauber for coming on the podcast. Again, folks, just a reminder, if you haven't done so, to subscribe to the Good Fight podcast feed on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, Stitcher, wherever it is you get your podcasts, and become a Patreon member of Hittin' Season by going to patreon.com/hittin'season and signing up on the $5 a month tier and get some of that good, sweet bonus content. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I'll talk to you next time right here on Hittin' Season.